I'm Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing from WNYC. Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
On my first day in office, I said I'd close Guantanamo Bay. Is it closed yet? No.
That's Fred Armisen on Saturday Night Live, adding to the show's distinguished line of oddly perfect presidential impressions that started with Chevy Chase. Now there is Fred, who also plays other important icons such as Larry King, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, Rupert Murdoch, and Prince.
Attention, sexy passengers. This groove jet's about to take off, so please direct your attention to my co-host, Miss Beyoncé Knowles.
Fred Armisen grew up in Valley Stream, Long Island, with a Venezuelan mother and a German father.
My mom really loved Saturday Night Live.
She did.
She loved it. I remember her talking about Chevy Chase, and she would say, like, oh, Chevy Chase, he's so funny. You just look at his face and you want to laugh. And that made a huge impression on me. And even as a kid, I thought, yeah, what is that? Like, a guy who, just from looking at him right away, you know, it was absolutely true.
He does nothing and you burst out laughing.
Yeah.
Armisen is also co-creator of Portlandia, a playfully subversive sketch comedy show on IFC in which he co-stars with the musician Kerry Brownstein.
I have to get up early for work, so let's get in our PJs and then we'll watch one more.
Okay, one more.
So good. How is it so good?
What time is it?
It's like daylight already. How did that even happen?
We just stayed up all night.
Do you want to watch more?
Portlandia, which he produces while SNL is on hiatus, recently won a Peabody Award.
Thank you so much for your guidance and for believing in the show and for allowing us a freedom, not to be reckless, but to be bold.
Fred Armisen is part of the American comedy landscape, but he took an unusual path to get there. For 10 years, he was a punk rock drummer in a band called Trenchmouth.
I worked so hard on that band. It was like an obsession for me, but it was like I just worked every day. We were in the van. We toured.
Booking places, bars, clubs. And just trying to get slots in clubs.
Yeah.
Over what area?
The whole United States and Canada.
And you were offloading and reloading your own equipment.
Yeah.
You were your own roadies.
Absolutely. We didn't bring any extra people to save money. Up and downstairs, middle of the night, lifting. Drums, cymbals, amps. Then, if it was a local show, flyers. Records, getting them out to people, getting them out to radio stations. It was nonstop.
And the same band?
Same band.
For nonstop. 10 years?
Let's see, 88 to, I'd say maybe 9 years.
Was it successful?
It depends how you look at
That's what I'm saying. I want to know your definition.
I had success in becoming closer with my friends. I had success in playing the drums. I played a lot of drums for a long time.
You enjoyed yourself?
Enjoyed myself. Traveled the country and
Drank
Europe.
Drank a lot?
I'm not much of a drinker. Played in Europe, played in the States. So absolutely, all that stuff was like, that's a success. Was it what I wanted? I wanted much more.
You did?
Much more.
Why?
Because I wanted to be as big. I remember, this is going to sound, I'll just be honest about what I wanted, but I wanted to be as big as the Red Hot Chili Peppers. I was like, God, they're huge. Yeah. They're huge. We can do it. So because we never attained that, and I would see bands from Chicago kind of swoop right by us, I saw it as not a success. And that's what kind of got me into doing comedy. In fact, I remember one band in particular. I remember seeing the drummer and saying to myself that, like, I don't want to be that.
Right.
And he was older than me, so he must have been, who knows what, 38, 40 or something like that. And he was a drummer and a very—
And you were how old?
I must have been 27, 29 or something.
He's 10 years older than you, and you said 10 years from now, I don't want to be
I saw he had some gray hair, and which is nothing wrong with that. I'm saying, but this what I did not like was that he was still lugging his equipment. And I was just like, I don't want to be that guy. I don't want to arrive in some town and find a place to stay. It just doesn't look nice.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like
You've done that.
Yeah, it's fine for— When you're in your 20s, it's great. We slept on floors, shared motel rooms, shared really like the worst kinds of places you could imagine.
Yeah,
you know?
But stuck together.
Stuck together.
Describe Trenchmouth's music. Who wrote the songs?
We all did together.
You all did?
Yeah.
When did the songwriting happen? You just like get together and say, today's rehearsal songwriting day?
Yeah, it's kind of like we had band practice every 3 times a week or something, twice a week. And you just sit in a room and you're like, I have this one part and I have this other part. And we just put them all together. But it was very frenetic and loud and percussive, and it was a cacophony of just like noise. I was a little bit of a ham, so like I really wanted to play a lot of drums, like Keith Moon style, you know.
Bonham.
Noise, noise, noise all the way through. And that was kind of like what a lot of bands were like that, so it was kind of just the way it was. It was pretty noisy, but I don't know. I love the drums. So
And you still play.
I do. I do. I love the drums.
Did you ever get invited to come play with somebody who was famous?
It depends what you consider famous. For me, it was the Bangles asked me to play with them recently. Yeah, I loved it. I loved it. I paid to go see the Bangles, and then at a show recently, they'll come up and play a song. Absolutely. And then
did you enjoy it?
I loved it. I loved it.
So you're really two people. There's you, the musical you.
Yeah.
And you don't want to let that die. And you still play every now and then.
Yeah.
You still have just a drum set?
Yeah. But I don't do anything like, I don't fancy myself like, hey, I'm still making music. I won't like put out like, you know, original songs and like, right. That no one needs to hear. You know, I'm grateful to be a comedian. I'm not like a struggling anything. But for fun, I will go and play music.
In 1998, Armisen went with his band to Austin, Texas for the South by Southwest Music Festival. Along with his drums, he brought a video camera.
And there were all these seminars and stuff on how to make it in the music biz. And somehow I got it in my head to interview people, do different characters. And it just became this video of...
And you'd never done anything like that before?
No.
You're down there and the whole... the whole experience down there was a musical one, but yeah. You start doing funny stuff.
And I don't even know why I did it. You know, I was just like, I just thought it would be a fun thing to do. And a friend of mine edited it together. And that tape, this is 1998, sort of made the rounds. They wrote about it in this local Chicago paper. And then I showed it at a club there that I used to play in Trenchmouth at this club. As many people turned out for that as with the band. So right away, I knew, like, oh, I could do this and not have to load in my equipment back and forth. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, the reaction was greater than when I was in a band. On that night, I thought, oh, this might be a way to go.
I'm here with the Aluminum Group. I just wanted to know from you guys, who thought up the name of the band? And I don't mean, like, originally. I mean, like, who was the person who decided that that was going to be the name? And what record label are you on? Is it the same record label that you're on a couple years ago? Or is it one that's going to be different? And is it the one that's going to be on in Europe?
Did everybody in Trenchmouth get really sad then? Did they know you were going to go?
Maybe. But they're my friends, so I think, you know, they kept on going with another band.
I called all of them, and they said they hate you, and they'll never forgive you.
Damn it.
No.
But hatred equals love.
Yeah, it's the flip side.
It's still an emotion.
It's still a warm emotion.
They're not ignoring me.
No.
I think we were already broken up or breaking up, so it was a very natural progression.
Right.
At the time, I was playing drums for Blue Man Group in Chicago.
Uh-huh.
So...
Now, that's doing the same thing every night, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's a show.
Yeah.
How'd that grab you?
I learned a lot.
You did?
I learned a lot from that show. Because, are you familiar with
yes.
the show? Pure Entertainment.
It's been playing down on Lafayette Street for like 900 years.
Pure Entertainment. You know, I'm up there in this sort of, the drums are above the stage, and you can kind of look down at the audience. And I learned that the audience is one just be entertained.
Yeah.
You don't have to overthink anything. If you're entertaining enough, they're there. They want something to do at night.
They're predisposed.
Yeah.
How long did you do that?
2 years.
2 years?
Yeah. It's the first time I got a paycheck for playing the drums. And to me, it was $1 million.
And the last.
And the last.
And the last.
Yeah. Yes,
after
absolutely.
That.
After that, comedy. So, that's the last
what
time
What did
I got,
you learn from Blue Man?
Simplicity, to not overthink ideas. Speed, they change from one bit, as it were, to the next very quickly. I think reinvention a little bit. They would keep sort of renewing the show a little bit just to keep it lively. That is what I came away with the most, that audiences want to be entertained.
And then what happens after that?
That's when I started doing comedy, and then...
Doing comedy where?
From those videos that I was telling you about, I started traveling the country showing it in L.A., San Francisco, New York.
So you made it into a stand-up act?
Kind of. I would just, you know, they'd write something in the paper, and people came out in all these cities, and then I went to L.A.
You played
and did
clubs?
It. Yeah.
Comedy clubs?
Rock clubs.
Rock clubs.
Yeah.
Where there was no music?
No music. Just showed this video and talked a little bit, and that's it.
And how long were you on stage?
I mean, total of like half an hour, 40 minutes.
Really?
Or something. Really short. Just
wow.
a little
and people
event.
Dug it?
Absolutely. It's pre-internet. So showing a video was more of an event.
More nouvelle.
Yeah. There was no such thing as like sort of, why don't you just watch it online?
Right.
And then someone from HBO was at one of the shows. And then I started doing these videos for HBO. They had like these other channels like HBO Zone, Latina. So there was something called HBO Zone, which is this sort of like alternative channel. And then I did these little interstitial pieces for them.
Who hired you to do that?
This woman, Elaine Brown.
She'd seen you. She'd found you.
It was through someone else who worked for a show called Reverb, which is a rock show on HBO.
Right.
So it was sort of indirect. I did some interviews for them. And then I started making enough money that I didn't have to live in Chicago anymore. I was like, I always wanted to live in L.A. I moved to L.A. And then I started doing stand-up, like characters and stuff on stage.
Where?
There's this one club that I loved called Largo. And people like David Cross and Bob Odenkirk and Marilyn Ricegub would perform there. And I just wanted to do the same thing, so I just started doing some stand-up there as different characters.
And so now are you in the full world of sitting down and writing for those shows? You're sitting down doing a lot of writing?
Then it's like, yes. No, I did all that for sure.
Yeah.
I moved to L.A. and I just wanted to fit in. You know, I was on my own and I just wanted to perform there and I would just do different characters.
Were all your friends back in Chicago?
Yeah.
Did you make all new friends right away? Did you fall into the comedy world?
Yeah, I did. I just wanted to be part of it. You know what I mean? So I think it was...
And you were open to it?
Yeah. And then I just...
And who became your pals there in L.A.?
Paul F. Tompkins. Bob Odenkirk really helped me out a lot. From doing stand-up there, he had a pilot for a show called Next, which had different characters, and it was a sort of variety show. And he got me onto the cast for that. And from that is where I had, like, all the tape to submit to SNL.
Hello, welcome to Focus on Talent. I am Gerhard Lipschitz, and today my very special guest is the wonderfully simple Ray Romano. Thank you so much for coming. This is really great. And you began in stand-up comedy and so, and I think that your act was not so good, yes?
Well, it seems to make people smile, I guess.
Yes, yes, but perhaps it is a yawn, and you are paid by the yawn, and that is why you're so rich, yes?
I had enough tape to submit to SNL. My agent and manager sent it to them, and then I was on the cast in 2002.
So you show up to New York to do the show.
I flew in to do the auditions. You know, I was flipping out that I even got to do the auditions
right.
at all.
That's a big thing.
Yeah, I mean, I met Tina Fey for the first time, Lauren, and...
Tina was the head writer then?
I believe so. I think her and Dennis McNicholas. I couldn't even believe I was in that studio. I'm still blown away by it.
And then when you started, you were a featured player.
Yeah.
And then how many years did you do that before you joined
the cast?
That was
2 years. It was Will Forte and I.
And was it frustrating to be a featured player? Because again...
No.
It wasn't.
I'm fresh from... carrying drums. I'm fresh from just doing stand-up at Largo.
So this is heaven.
I can't... There's a part of me that still is like, I can't believe it.
A lot of people on the show don't sense that. They leave and they don't realize how good they've had it, but it's a good show.
People who have left the show have told me, and I listen to them, and they say it's the best job I ever had.
Yeah, it's going to be one of them. You know, you're not going to have that much freedom and that much variety. I always tell people, don't leave the show and become the thing you made fun of on the show.
Right.
You know, that's a real trap.
Yeah.
Because you're going to go out there and do other jobs. And one of the greatest risks in my mind is that people will characterize you.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I can see you doing a movie where you're with a really smart cast and a smart director, and you, like, lock everybody in the gymnasium and burn the gymnasium down to the ground. You could go either way, don't you think?
I hope so.
Do you want to do straight acting?
That's tricky.
Why?
If there's a way to do it, it's tricky because I don't want to look like I'm unhappy with comedy. Right. I don't want to go out there and say, for lack of a better word, an audience like, hey, this is what I really do. However, I think these days there are roles that are both comedic and dramatic.
Right.
I like that line is becoming blurry. So my answer is kind of like, I think there's a way that Peter Sellers did it, where it was right. It comedy or was it not comedy? Somewhere in
but
there.
But he occupies a very, very distinct place. I mean, yeah. You have comic actors
yeah.
who've made their reputation in comedic roles,
right?
Who've tried to go over into dramatic films and it's worked to some degree or hasn't worked, you know, Billy Crystal and Robin Williams and so forth.
Right.
And I think you have a real opportunity, and it's never more vivid than it is in Portlandia, that you could go both ways and do the yeah. comic and the dramatic. Do you feel that way?
Yes, because when we do the show, when we write the show, we don't always think about, like, what's the funniest thing?
Right.
Like, what seems interesting to us? What's going to look
and if
nice?
If the funny comes, it comes.
Great. If it's not quite comedy, that's okay. Like, it's something else in between.
I did. Mm-hmm. I did read that. Do you hear the thing at McSweeney's? I was comparing CD tracks and album tracks. Did you read that?
Yeah. Did you read that thing in Mother Jones about eco chairs and eco ways to sit?
I did.
Yeah.
I did. Did you read that thing in Spin about all the festivals?
Did you read that thing in Pace? It was about the National.
Oh, I saw that. Did you see that thing in Dwell about all the mid-century houses?
Yeah. Did you read the New York Times?
Yes.
New York Observer?
Yes.
Washington Post?
Yes.
Wall Street Journal?
Of course I read it.
Did you read that steampunk article in Boing Boing?
I did not like the end of it.
Did you read that skywriting over the Willamette River?
Yes. Did you read the fortune cookie?
Yes.
From last night?
Yes.
Did you read it?
Yes.
There were two.
Yes. Did you read that thing that guy wrote in the sand on the beach?
Yeah.
Did you read the Portland Mercury?
Yeah.
Did you read the Willamette Week?
Yeah.
Did you read the Seattle Stranger?
Beginning to end.
Did you read the SF Weekly?
I loved it.
I think everybody who would listen to this podcast knows Carrie Brownstein from the show.
Yeah.
But did you know Carrie when? When did you meet her?
I met her in 2003, I think. But we had mutual friends going back to.
So you just started the feature playing bit of the contract.
Yeah. But I knew the drummer in her band, Janet, in 1997 or 1998.
And Carrie lived in Portland or L.A.?
Portland. And her band was like my favorite band, this band Slater Kinney. I became friendly with them. We just had a lot of mutual friends. They came to New York to play. I just invited them to come to the show. They had a show that night, so they came to the after party, and I met Carrie there. And it was the strangest thing. Carrie and I just became instant friends.
Mm-hmm. That happens. And she knew who you were from the TV show?
Yeah, right. Fully. It just worked out.
You clicked.
Yeah, ever since then.
And then how soon after that? I mean, what was the relationship like between that and when you started Portlandia, which is only how many years old now?
Portlandia's, we're going to our third season.
You started hatching it 4 years ago, let's say.
Further back than that, we had a website where we would make little videos.
Right. Oh, this was the birth of that, was this video thing
yeah,
as well.
Yeah, Thunder Ant.
Thunder Ant.
Yeah. So it was. We just made these
Who
videos.
Who came up with that name?
Well, it was going to be Thunder Egg, which is the Oregon State Rock. Mm-hmm. And then there was a band called Thunder Egg. So we're like, out of respect, we're like, let's think of something else. And we just came up with Thunder Ant. And we just made these videos. You know, I'd go to Portland. It was like the equivalent of jamming, you know?
Yeah.
And so instead of doing that, which is just like, so what? You know, like, hey, we have this band. We just thought, let's make these videos. There was no pressure on it. It was just like, let's just
you
make
You just erase it if you didn't like it.
Yeah, for no reason. Let's just come up with characters. Let's make these tapes. And then we did. And then we had just all these videos on this website.
I remember reading that you did about a dozen of them, correct?
Yeah, that's about right. And then we just had enough to pitch a TV show.
And then how does Portlandia become a show? Who buys the show?
It was a kind of a thing where I was just talking to my manager. What do you want to do next? What's something you want to work on? I thought, Thunder Ant. Let's just turn it, see if we can turn it into something. And then Carrie and I just thought, yeah, let's pitch it.
Ready for that? Does she want that?
Yeah.
She seems like somebody who lived in Portland and lived on the fringe and was very, very talented deliberately.
Yes.
That she didn't want to be mainstream successful.
I think she just likes doing it.
Right.
So
she does what she wants.
She's a perfect mix of like she just enjoys, you know, performing and isn't like so crazy ambitious that she's like, okay, what's the next thing? What's the next thing? She's very like, let's work on some projects. And a lot of it's our friendship. We just like working together. And then we pitched it to Broadway Video, Andrew Singer, and then to, you know, Lauren. And as a group, we pitched it to IFC. They said, go ahead and do a pilot, which we did. And then next thing we knew, we're doing the show.
And you shoot the show in Portland, obviously.
Yeah.
And what was it like to crew up a show there? I mean, is there a lot of production up there?
Yeah. I mean, it was incredible. I mean, we had – I didn't have time to stop and think about, wow, isn't this cool? We just had to get, you know, a director, John Kreisel. We had to get, you know, producers, line producers on board. So there was a lot to do. And then we had to come up with the sketches, too.
And where is the production facility?
We just shoot on location.
On location. Where's the production offices? In some defunct building?
Yeah.
Missile factory?
It was like this old
sneaker factory?
It was like an abandoned sports store.
Exactly.
or sports something, action sports something, some like.
Is the production office for the show?
It was. It just changed, and then it changed the second year. We just, you know, it's. Which I kind of like, at first I didn't like, but it's something I've grown to like, is it just changes to whatever's the cheapest place to rent space.
Right.
I think when things are permanent, that's kind of a scary thing, because then you just assume too much.
Is there a lot of other production in Portland? I mean, is there a lot of other stuff
shot
there?
There's a few other things. Leverage is shot there. Grimm is shot there. But I think that's it. Maybe.
So not a lot is shot there.
Not a lot. Not a lot. I think it's nice that everyone's employed. You know, anything that brings employment to a city, it's got to be great.
Now, when you go there, I'm assuming, to start the show, you'd never lived there before.
No, but I'd gone there so much.
You had, because you'd spent so much time. So you knew what this Portland head was that you wanted to comment on.
I mean, that's what also got us to doing the show there. I mean, like, I would visit Carrie all the time. I'd shoot Thunder Ant. For years, I've been going there.
And she'd lived there for how long? Forever.
For a while. I think she's originally from Washington State, and then she moved to Portland, whatever, you know, right. 10 years ago or something.
So what is your experience being in Portland? Do people say stuff to you all the time about the show? They just love it.
They're so nice about it. And I really like it there. You know, I'm a city guy. I'm from New York, and I still love it there. It's smaller, but it's still a city, and clean and nice, and it's good food everywhere.
Civil.
Really civil, really just physically pretty. And kind of overcast, which I really like.
Do you think when SNL is over, you'll stay in New York? Or do you think Los Angeles is where you're going to end up going?
I'm going to try.
Yeah.
I'm sure I'll spend some time in LA and some time in Portland, but I mean, I love it here.
Do you develop films now? Do you write films at all for yourself?
I've started to.
Yeah, you got a good idea.
I've started to, yeah. Yeah. I feel like when I try to write something for myself, it ends up in TV form, but still, I want to try to expand that.
You would never do a TV series?
I would do anything. Anything that seems interesting, I would do. Anything that seems like something, you know, good to be part of.
So when you sign a contract, like with Broadway Video, for those people who don't know this, that's Lauren's company, his production arm, and you have to deliver how many episodes?
10.
You just do 10.
First one was 6, second was 10, this one's going to be 10 also.
So this one's going to be 10.
10's a lot.
That's what I was going to say, because eventually you start again when?
As soon as I'm done with SNL,
You're going to go right out to Portland with Carrie and start again and do 10. And that 10 will take you through the summer?
Yeah.
So you spend your whole summer working with Carrie, then you come back to SNL.
Yeah.
You have a little bit of a break.
No. In fact, it overlaps a little bit. I might have to miss some, maybe a little bit of rehearsing when we come right back next year, because I think it's going to bleed into October a little bit.
What do you do for fun?
I just work all the time.
Well, you just work.
Yeah.
Because this is what you wanted.
Yeah. Today I'm going to go into work and we're going to start writing, and it's work, but it's still, you know, trying to think of things for the show.
What do you watch on TV?
Lately, Game of Thrones.
You do? Why?
I'm very addicted to every story that's going on in that show. It's so well done. It's so well done. And it's a weird mix of like, it's kind of historical, not historical.
Right.
I guess at this point it's just fantasy, but like, it's just so well done. I really, really love it. Downton Abbey is really fun to watch.
And I have to watch that. I haven't watched that.
Girls is really great. That show's great. Veep, so many great things.
I always remember Favreau had that show, Dinner for Five.
I remember that, yeah.
I used to watch that show. I love that show. And Favreau had these people on, and Favreau's talking to these people, and he says, well, you know, in the movie business, there's three things. There's the director, there's the script, and there's the cast. And he said, you can afford to take a chance on one of the three. He said, but if two of the three, let alone three, but if two are in doubt or you have questions about it, he said, don't do the movie. I remember sitting there in my bed, and I had already been in the movie business for like, you know, I was 40 years old or 45 years old. I remember sitting there going, damn, now he tells me. Damn you, John Favreau.
Yeah, that's really good.
He taught me a big lesson.
Yeah.
Did you ever meet someone who was an idol of yours and you really had an amazing experience chatting with them?
Oh, absolutely.
For example?
Steve Martin.
Right.
I mean...
Oh, him.
he's, you know, it's even weird talking about it because I feel like I know him somewhat.
Yeah, sure.
But in the comedy world or in the entertainment world, he's just like, the experience is greater than I ever thought it would be.
Right.
Because I idolize him. And then on top of it, the way he is. You know, that's part of the thing, seeing how people are as people. That's another nice surprise.
Yeah, he's a very sweet guy.
He's just, yeah, and he loves art, and that's like, yeah.
You seem very goal-oriented. You've had goals.
Yeah.
You wanted to be in the band. You did the band. You did that till you were done. You put it down. You went to this. You've moved along.
Yeah.
What else do you want to do?
Someday want to invent a type of entertainment that is really blurry between comedy and something else that doesn't have a name yet. But I do want to see if there's another way to – another level of fooling people as opposed to just doing a character, something a little bigger than that. And I don't know quite how to do it yet, but
Do you think being famous has killed that opportunity for you personally?
Sometimes.
So that someone – you'd have to get someone else to do it.
Maybe,
you'd have to write and produce that.
Yeah.
And because you couldn't do that.
Yeah.
Because the minute you show up, they know something's going on.
But yeah.
Do you find that? Do you find that when you walk up to people automatically, like someone said something to me, they said to me, you're at a wonderful place, which is also a terrible place.
Yeah.
That place where people are going to laugh at you whether you're funny or not. And right. He meant it as a dig.
Yeah.
Do you find that's true with you, that wherever you go, people are predisposed to you saying something?
Yeah. Or if I do like a stand-up show somewhere, I find that I want to put more effort into it, but sometimes I don't really have to. Right. So that might not be a good thing.
Right.
So,
what about in your personal life? How has your personal life changed as a result of being famous?
It's everything I ever wanted, but there are some things about it that are just very new and just very interesting. You know, like I love New York. I love riding on the subway. My subway rides aren't as private as they used to be.
Right.
That's when I start trying to think of ideas. I listen to music, and that's just different now.
And people say things to you.
Yeah. Perfectly nice. Perfectly nice. I would have done the same had I met whoever. But that's changed. It's like a different kind of subway ride.
What about your relationship with your family, your friends? I mean, do you still have the same friends?
Yeah, kind of. But I've grown, you know, gotten new friends, obviously.
New circles of friends come with each ladder you go up.
Yes. But I've maintained my friendships with the guys in the old band and
people. Odenkirk?
Yeah, absolutely.
He's in L.A., though, right?
Yeah. We just text each other and, yeah. So I do maintain relationships with these. Even if we're both busy, Paul F. Tompkins, whoever, I still try to keep those alive.
This is the last thing I want to say to you, which
you could say a million things to me.
Well, but I'm saying that without getting too personal, you know, you've been married twice.
Yeah.
And do you find – you were married twice, correct?
That's correct. And the first one was in Chicago before I was doing comedy.
Right.
And that's someone who I'm still friends with, right. Sally.
That was during the music days.
Yes, yeah.
The Keith Moon days.
Yeah.
And then you were married the second time.
Yes.
But would you say that, like, from things I've read, you find that because of what you crave and what you love, you speak very lovingly about Carrie and how you and she are just friends.
Yeah.
But she's like your, you know – she's your, like, last text of the day.
Yeah.
Do you think that she's kind of your soulmate?
Without a doubt. It's all the things that I've ever wanted, you know, aside from, like, the physical stuff.
Right.
But the intimacy that I have with her is, like, no other. Like, it's something that – and it's taken me a while to realize. I'm like, wait a minute. I am super, super close with her. I mean, we work all day together on Portlandia, and then we hang out afterwards.
Yeah.
I mean, what is that?
Because people don't understand in this business how important that is. Like, it depends on who the person is.
Yeah. I also feel like you want someone who you can be not great around. Meaning, you know, like I want to be able to be kind of boring sometimes or say something dumb and it's okay.
Yeah.
That pressure is, I like that pressure not to be there, to have to be super funny and intelligent all the time. It's nice when I like.
Not that competitive.
Yeah, where I'm just like.
But the comedy world is very competitive, isn't it?
I guess. I haven't walked into that too much.
Right.
I wasn't part of a comedy troupe or anything. And so, and the stand-ups I've become friends with, I've all been very, you know, supportive. Definitely.
Depending on the outcome of the election, you can expect to see more of Fred Armisen on SNL next season as Barack Obama, but definitely more of Prince. Portlandia is entering its third season on IFC. Can I play a customer in Portlandia? Can I come to a restaurant?
Anytime.
Can I come and just do something? Can I order a... Who would I play and what would I order?
I think you would come from Southern California... And you'd order all kinds of meats. A meat aficionado. People think of it as a veggie place, but it's actually a very meaty place.
They're
very into, yeah, it's very like cured meats and sausages. But we haven't explored that much.
Maybe I could be a meat salesman.
Yeah, even better.
Maybe I could be a meat salesman with all even kinds better. Of charts and graphs of the loins and Anytime. Pictures of the sections of the pig and the cow and the organs and the pig salesman.
Yeah, I love it. And the answer is yes.
Great.
Anytime.
I'll come see you in Portland.
Yeah.
This is Alec Baldwin. Here's The Thing comes from WNYC Radio.